Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show.
Roguecast episode 269, recorded September 17th, 2019. We did not exist in podcast 4.
So we weren't here last week.
Right.
Well, we were here.
We were here. The recording equipment was here. The comics were not here.
We did not exist in podcast form.
There was some. We did not exist in podcast form.
Yeah, I don't know if y'all know, but when we do this, we actually change shape.
That's
yeah.
true.
That's right. We all have these kind of like Tron-like costumes because it's like all the high-tech podcast stuff is
going
on.
But it's like that picture that dude in the Tron costume.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, completely.
Man,
we don't have cool Tron costumes.
I don't know if people know about this, but he was like a pudgy cosplayer of Tron who was like just in love with it. And like his fandom got eventually noticed where he was like in a commercial.
Yeah.
Like, and people probably, they might have at least seen that, but I don't know if people knew the backstory that he was a legit like Uber nerd.
Yeah.
Anyway, that is in fact what's going on.
Anyway, yeah, we didn't have comics until
but we're
Wednesday.
Back in Tron costumes. Yeah, this was all weird UPS delays and things like that.
What we heard was maybe the hurricane
delayed
it. At any rate, we didn't have to talk about, so we skipped last week's podcast. We had to sort of scramble our schedule a little bit,
and now we're back with a vengeance. Right,
we're back. So
with a vengeance.
With a vengeance. Thank you, Dave. So we have a couple things. We may in our other comics section throw in a couple things from last week that we read this week. Otherwise, it'll be just like last week never happened.
Yep. Yep. We're trying to put it behind us.
Yeah.
The sad days. It is frustrating, though, because I think there's always, like, news we want to talk about, comics we want to talk about, and, you know, one late shipment throws off the whole story. So we have to, like, reschedule everybody on staff to, like, accommodate the new comics arrivals and all that.
And we have to pull the comics in an hour instead of 3 hours.
Yep, and we don't get a chance to preview of them and to better recommend them for you, which is what we live for.
It's true.
So yeah, this is a nice, normal week.
Batman Days is Saturday.
Man, that just snuck up, Batman does.
From the shadows.
So, Batman himself, well, not Batman himself, a guy dressed as Batman, I don't want to promise too much, will be here. He's not going to shoot any horses.
If you happen to...
He didn't shoot, it was Catwoman.
If you, he was,
He's going to wear a sign that says it was Catwoman.
and he's got a cat, the horse shooting was an inside job.
Yes.
Catwoman shot first.
Yes, Catwoman shot first. God.
Anyway, we have a guy dressed as Batman here for about 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock.
If you've got little ones, they may believe him to be Batman.
Yes.
And so that'll be cool.
Yeah. But to be clear, we'll not be shooting any animals.
Yep.
And then we have one cosplayer friend of ours who may come as a Batgirl if she gets it done in time. We'll see. But also, there'll be free Batman comics for the first, like, 50 to 100 people. We will have a 10% sale on everything Batman that day.
Nice.
So, come out to Batman Days.
If I had thought about it, we should have, like, rounded up some Batman graphic novels. I know we've got all our usual suspects, Batman Year One and Long Halloween and stuff like that. But it would have been fun to throw out some unusual ones. Maybe we can sneak them in the next segment of the podcast, and everything I'm saying right now will be irrelevant because we are going to mention them.
That's not going to happen.
I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it.
News. So, Hayley Atwell has joined Mission Impossible 7.
Hayley Atwell, a.k.a.
Agent Carter.
Carter. That's pretty cool.
That's a good fit. I like her. I don't know if she's going to be a villain or a member of the team.
Hopefully a member of the team that sticks around for a couple of movies.
Or she's going to voice their sentient plane.
Is that a thing?
I don't know. It could be.
Okay.
There's 7 Mission Impossible. They're going to do something weird.
They're generally...
It's not the Fast and Furious movies, right? They're not going to go to the moon.
If you do join the team in those, you're going to probably get a few movies.
Always the case. For the first couple, the only one that stuck around was Ving Rhames.
Everybody else died.
I said generally. Yep. But that's become the tradition in the last few movies. So Simon Pegg's been around a few movies now, right?
Yep. Yep.
Who else joined the cast?
I mean, Ving Rhames went and came back.
Right.
There's the woman whose name I can never remember, who's the British
yeah.
agent.
And what's a Hawkeye guy?
Jeremy Renner. He's only been in one?
No, he was in the second one.
He was in another one as
because
secretary.
But he was going to take over as the lead in Mission Impossible, and then Tom Cruise was like, I'm not done yet.
That was the plan, hand it off.
And he became Hawkeye again.
I guess it worked out for everybody.
Yeah. Except for Jeremy Renner.
I don't know. I think he likes playing Hawkeye.
Sure. He didn't get to lead a mega franchise.
Yeah.
He gets to lead a Disney Plus TV
show. He tried twice and it didn't really work.
That's Tom Cruise's baby. He's got to play it until he's 80. and it's sad, and we get the Kingdom of Crystal Skull of Mission Impossible.
Mission Impossible 12, the Crystal Skull.
That's right.
All
bad movies should ultimately tie into that Crystal Skull.
I shouldn't even say this, but he will probably die filming a movie trying to do some stupid stuff.
Oh, I think that's probably
yeah.
true.
Yeah. He's going to surf on a drone or something like that and just plummet to the ground.
Yeah, and then they'll do the same thing Fast and Furious did. They'll have a thing where he retires.
Yeah.
And they keep naming things after him, even though his character is alive.
Maybe they can have Jeremy Renner come in, stand in as his double, and they digitally put Tom Cruise's face on him so for his final scenes.
It's possible. By the time Tom Cruise does...
There's digital stuff. They can hobbit him.
By the time Tom Cruise goes, we might have purely digital actors. So
that's true. That's true. The point is, I like planning their deaths.
Yeah, good call. For the record, if he does die this week, Dave is theoretically planning his death. He's not planning to murder Tom Cruise.
I'm culpable.
Some Suicide Squad news. First of all, James Gunn unveiled the Suicide Squad cast with a series of names in the font from the Ostrander series. I don't know if you guys noticed that.
Yeah, right. Yeah. The single most iconic incarnation of the team, and the one that launched this whole, basically the idea of the supervillains working for the government.
And all he posted was, don't get too attached, hashtag the Suicide yes. Squad.
And there was like a dozen or more names, so there was like...
Oh, there's a ton. So there's a few names I don't recognize, but John Cena is on there.
Yep.
Nathan Fillion. Flula Borg, who you might know from the Pitch Perfect movies, Pitch Perfect 2.
Some people might.
Pete Davidson from Saturday Night Live. Taika Waititi is in there as an actor.
Right, we're hoping he's going to play King Shark, right?
That's the hope.
Peter Capaldi.
Yeah.
Steve Agee, who was comedian duties, one of the Ravagers in Guardians 2.
Okay.
So one thing that we can tell from this is that... what's the director?
James Gunn.
James Gunn. Is definitely going to embrace the notion of some cannon fodder in there. The book was John Ostrander, when he was writing this series in the late 80s and early 90s, came up with a really good balance of, like, sometimes you get these lame villains brought into the squad and they would be cannon fodder.
Yep.
Sometimes he'd bring them in, though, and he'd make you care about them and still kill them.
Yeah.
Sometimes he'd bring them in and make you care about them and make them major characters. So, like, you never knew quite where that was going, and since that's the template I know that James Gunn is looking to, or that's the keynote he's looking is the Ostrander Suicide Squad run, that's really cool. The only thing I hope is that he doesn't actually... kill off too many people to the point where, like, it kind of becomes, you know, death feels easy, or nobody matters. I don't think he will.
No,
he definitely likes you to care about his characters.
But there will be some schlocky kind of fun deaths.
Yeah. I have wondered if they might begin with a cold open of, like, the tail end of some other mission, and you see, like, some incarnation just get, like, wiped out. You know, like, six guys die all at once.
I want to see their heads explode, because they have to wear the collars.
They could do that. In fact, I'm sure somebody's going to go because they tried to run.
Yep. Well, they have to show that that's not a bluff.
Yep.
That's what they did in the comics. I'm sure they'll do it in the movie.
Yep.
I think I heard John Cena was playing, potentially, Peacemaker.
Oh, interesting.
I could see it.
I actually would like it.
Am I right? Peacemaker was the analog to the comedian from Charlton Comics.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder who Peter Capaldi's playing. That's an interesting person.
He could be one of those, like, who was that guy who, like, stalked Oracle, who was, like, the thinker.
That was the thinker.
No, I know. I was just saying, like, there's been other versions of the thinker before that were not young punks.
Yeah.
That was, like, cyberpunk.
Peter Capaldi as the calculator.
Yeah, there's somebody like that. I could see them picking somebody who's one of those, like, planner or psychic villains or something like that.
What if all these people are playing Captain Boomerang?
What if Peter Capaldi is playing Bronze Tiger?
No, Jai Courtney is playing Captain Boomerang.
He's actually
just posted on his Twitter him donning his gold tooth again.
Jai Courtney and Joel Kinnaman and Viola Davis are all back. Margot Robbie's back.
Yep.
That was a surprise. I did not think Margot Robbie was going to be in this.
Yeah.
Do we know if she's going to be like a major character, or is she going to be kind of guesting?
It could be a cameo. We don't really know.
I bet the cold opening kind of, is her escaping.
I could easily see that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm excited about a DC movie.
Pretty interesting.
All you gotta do is get James Gunn in there. If the Russo brothers start doing DC movies, just bring everybody who made Marvel success. Just copy them. It's fine.
Gunn doing a John Ostrander inspired Suicide Squad movie is probably...
I'm all about it.
Yeah.
So, speaking of Suicide Squad, Tom Taylor and Bruno Redondo, who did Injustice 2, are doing a Suicide Squad book, which they're calling basically a reboot. It's their starting new issue one.
Ongoing series. Ongoing not many series.
I love Tom Taylor, and I feel like this is a perfect fit for him.
I like Tom Taylor quite a bit, and I feel like it's a good fit as well.
Yeah. I'm going to read it.
What, you can't commit, Dave? You can't commit to loving Tom Taylor?
He's not that good.
Lately, he's not been as great as he once was.
You know what? Okay. Friend of the Neighborhood Spider-Man has definitely come on strong.
One in every three issues is sucko. No, I just haven't. I haven't glommed onto everything he's done. But yeah, that I think this is a win.
Yeah,
it's nice to get a movie like know that we're gonna get probably a good Suicide Squad movie, and then there's probably gonna be a new book that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
It was a little sad when we had a, I'm gonna say mixed bag at best Suicide Squad movie accompanied by a very bad Suicide Squad comic.
I would agree with half of that.
I would imagine we're gonna get these simultaneously.
I think probably
close enough.
It'll work.
Yeah, like the comic may hit first, but like maybe they'll have the first trade paperback when the movie's hitting or something like that.
Yeah.
When is the movie hitting?
It's not till like 2021.
Okay. Yeah, they got Tom Taylor have his comic out. All right.
I thought it was next year for some reason.
I thought it was too, but I think I heard that it was like August 2021 or something.
Okay. Well.
I don't know if that's true.
That's not going to be the case. We'll get a Tom Taylor Suicide Squad book the next 3 months.
It'll be canceled by the time the movie comes out.
They let that other Suicide Squad book go to, I think, at least issue 50 60.
They did. Yep. It had more than the original.
And that's the sales were dwindling pretty hard at the end.
Jumping over from Margot Robbie, she is talking about doing a Tank Girl reboot.
Yeah, I know our former staffer now, Julie, was very excited about that. She's a Tank Girl aficionado. I think she's a good fit for it.
Yeah, I do too.
I feel like she could pull off the Lori Petty, right. that was the original actress type vibe. She's an actress who's distinguished herself in a pretty wide variety of areas. I don't know who her casting agent is, but I feel like Margot Robbie's casting agent is doing a damn good job.
Yeah, she's done a bunch of good
stuff.
She's
hitting genre movies. She's hitting, serious acting movies.
Yeah.
This sounds like another fun one. Yeah. And a character who's kind of I'm going to say radical ass-kicking feminist bent, I think, but with
a kangaroo boyfriend.
With a kangaroo boyfriend and some sneering sarcasm and some post-apocalyptic backdrop stuff. It feels like the time is right.
I agree. Alexander Skarsgård, who I believe plays the evil clown Pennywise. Is that right?
Yes. I mixed up the Skarsgårds, but I believe that's the one.
Yes.
And then was he also in the show?
No, Bill Skarsgård is the one who does Pennywise.
Oh, right.
Bill Skarsgård.
Alexander Skarsgård is he's like a muscle man who played like Tarzan and
he was
he's done other more physical
heroes.
And he
was also on Big Little Lies as the kind of culprit of everything.
Yep.
Okay. He has been cast as Randall Flagg in the Stand series on CBS All Access.
It's a good role for him. He'll chew the scenery.
Is Randall Flagg the same as the guy as the Man in Black?
Yes.
That's what I thought.
Or that is to say they're incarnations or whatever.
No, it's technically, I think the same
is
person.
Is he literally the same, the
I
same
thought he
dude?
Was.
Like, there's no difference between their demeanor or anything like that?
I didn't think there was.
Is there
very
a
much.
Link between Pennywise and the Man in Black?
That's what I was trying to figure out the other day.
No, but Pennywise has shown up in Dark Tower stuff before.
Okay.
Yeah. And I suspect that, who he represents, may have some link to Randall Flagg.
But that's spoiling too much. Pennywise is not an evil clown. He's like an evil alien life form or something, right?
It's if you extra-dimensional is probably a better maybe word than alien, but
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Whose arch-nemesis is a turtle.
That's true.
What?
The movie did not get into the turtle stuff, and I was sad.
I know.
They hinted at it, two or three times with, a Lego turtle and some other stuff, but that was just a little wink to the fans. You know King is a crazy person.
I do.
You know he uses the cocaine.
Yep.
He certainly did.
Yeah. And that said, he wrote a damn good book on it. Remember, kids, do drugs. that's if anything, this podcast is out there to teach you.
Wow.
Jeez.
That was Dave, for the record.
Sorry, it's this Tron suit. It's making me itchy and squirrely.
Why is it so powdery? Is your Tron suit covered in cocaine?
there is a thing, though, in the book, Randy, where there's a incarnation of a You know, the same way Marvel has the Eternals and things like that, these, like, universal forces are more like the Living Tribunal and the Inbetweener and the Eternity
it's on that
and all
scale.
That. There is a sort of semi-sentient turtle-type creature that is a representation of a more positive manifestation than the...
The world lives on the back of the turtle.
Yeah.
And does that tie
actually,
into...
I believe he was supposed to have vomited up the universe in one of those things that's a little bit more like old-time mythology.
Does that turtle tie into Mama Abigail from The Stand somehow? Is she a turtle in some way?
I don't think she was, but I wouldn't be shocked if she didn't have, like,
shocked.
A dream of some sort.
I have not read any of The Dark Tower, but I would like to do a series wherein, maybe every week, there's a segment on the show where I ask you guys to explain bits of The Dark Tower universe.
Because the turtle does definitely appear in The Dark Tower series.
I was curious to learn more about it. I have not read The Dark Tower, so it'd be interesting the answers I would give you, Randy.
So what I would like, Dave, is to ask you, you give me your interpretation based on what you've heard of discussions, and then Nick corrects whatever.
I could absolutely do this.
Yes, all right.
Now, we said he's been cast as Randall Flagg in The Stand miniseries?
I believe it's a miniseries on CBS All Access, okay. Yeah.
I think most of our listeners know it, but that's Stephen King's epic post-apocalyptic sort of thing where a virus has wiped out most of humanity, like, what, 95% or so? And then there is also, like, this almost sort of, like, religious quality to it where, like, a dark leader who seems like he's almost a devil-like figure is rallying certain factions, even as this woman named Mother Abigail seems to be rallying the factions of the halfway decent people in the world.
And they fight in Las Vegas, right?
Yeah. And so Randall Flagg is his scary guy, sometimes called the Walking Dude, sometimes called the Man in Black as well.
Sometimes called Johnny Cash.
Sometimes called Johnny Cash.
I know the Man in Black, so I'm pretty sure that's true.
Did I hear that, like, they were eyeing, like, Whoopi Goldberg for...
Mother Abigail?
I could see that.
Or, I hadn't heard that, but it would make sense.
I could absolutely see that.
Yeah. So that's either a rumor that we've heard or something Dave made up in his own head.
But it would make sense.
Yeah. And we're for it.
I actually enjoyed the... Was it CBS who did the original... miniseries?
I don't know who produced it. I do know that was my first encounter with it. I hadn't read that many King books at the time. I watched that and I really liked it.
I did too.
That warts and all.
That opening couple of episodes are scary.
Yeah,
as hell.
The Don't Fear the Reaper.
Yeah,
as they're showing everybody.
It's a startling sequence, and the thing is, like, it's not showing them dying. It's just an endless pan over that song of corpses.
Yeah.
They're all dead.
Yep.
Everybody's dead.
It was Gary Sinise who was the lead, right?
Oh, yeah. It was ABC.
It was ABC.
Holy crap. It was Rob Lowe's return.
Yep.
Gary Sinise, Miguel Ferrer, Rob Lowe, Austin
Molly
Davis,
Ringwald.
Molly Ringwald, Lawrence and Giacomo, Ed Harris, and Matt Frewer were all in it.
Matt Frewer was the trash can man.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there's a disturbing character.
Yeah.
Man, it's a good show.
So, yeah, and I have a feeling this is going to be a better new incarnation, but yeah, not to knock the old show, which... definitely kind of keyed my interest in it, and it was really cool to read the book a couple years later and see all the stuff the movie didn't
I wonder if they
have.
Will have my most freaked out sequence where Rob Lowe's character, I forget that character's name, crawling through the Lincoln Tunnel over corpses.
Absolutely. It's one of the iconic scenes from it, so there's no doubt it'll be in there.
It creeped my, whatever age I was, just the idea of that.
Basically a pitch black tunnel with somebody walking over like a sea of corpses in it. I definitely remember the point where his foot goes through one of them and punctures its skin and just goes into, like, a dead stomach.
Yeah.
Good times?
Yeah.
Good times.
Yeah. Robert Kirkman's Super Dinosaur is coming to Amazon Prime on October 6th. It's going to be 13 animated episodes. I gather it might have already aired in, like, England or something.
Huh.
But it's kind of cool for kids.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember reading the comic when it came out, and I thought it was fine.
Yeah.
I mean, it was... Like,
did it turn super violent the way Invincible did?
All, everything he does.
I don't think it did, because it's actually in our all ages section right
and he
now.
Did. It was, specifically marketed that way, whereas I don't think Invincible ever proclaimed that it was going to be PG forever.
Okay. It lasted PG for, like, an issue.
Right. That's really the truth.
All right. The last bit of news is potentially a pretty big spoiler for Superman. It's an event that's going to happen in December.
Superman comics.
If you don't want to know, just skip to the next break. I've got in the show notes where we start talking about comics.
And avoid all social media.
And avoid all social media, because, what it finally convinced you we should go ahead and talk about is that it's already out there, so probably it's going to become common knowledge 2 months before the comic is produced, as is now tradition. Thank you, Internet. All right, with that prelude out of the way, we have heard, without too many specifics, that Superman's Secret Identity may be going bye-bye in December.
If you, by chance, those people out there who are not a fan of Bendis' writing all must have collectively said, oh my god, of course he did it.
Yep.
Because
that was my reaction.
Bendis outs the secret identity of every superhero he ends up writing, from Peter Parker in like Ultimate Spider-Man
to
Daredevil. It's just a thing he does. He doesn't like secret identities. I've been I do think that philosophy informed like the Marvel movies in a pretty decent way,
and it kind of works, yeah.
But I tend to like a somewhat of a middle ground, and I don't know if I mentioned this on the podcast before, but the Flash TV show was one is sort of the middle ground I like. And I guess that's really in the Arrowverse too, where you got a small group of friends who know your deal, so you don't have to lie to them all the time and have those obnoxious tropes where you lose the girl because you kept on running out because you had to fight Dr. Doom.
Yep.
Right? That's an annoying and old trope.
I've lost more relationship that way.
But yeah, it is based in reality, of course.
Yeah.
But so I like that where like most people don't know, but you know your peeps do. But I guess Superman is gonna lose it all, and what I think, the one thing that I thought about this that I sort of liked, is that I feel like Bendis is probably gonna lean into the notion that Superman is an immigrant hero. It's always been brought up, you know, people bring it up occasionally, not always, but it's been brought up occasionally. If everybody on Earth in DC knows that he is an immigrant, arguably an illegal immigrant, he never went through proper protocols. He didn't come here the right way. Then there's an interesting story to be told there. This guy who we consider the best of us. I don't know. What do y'all think? Nick, do you have an interest in this? You're probably the closest we've got to a Bendis fan or a semi-Bendis fan.
I go back and forth on the idea of losing all secret identities.
Yeah.
Because I kind of agree that...
I guess the costumes that superheroes wear have always been at least somewhat based around the idea of hiding them.
Yeah.
Marvel, it seems like less of a big deal.
Yeah.
I mean, you have people like Spider-Man where it's possible that... That's still kind of a close secret kind of thing.
That old cliche where, like, oh, if they know who I am, the villains will just come after me and my family, does feel kind of true, because they're not like a cop where it's their police can stay sort of relatively anonymous. You know, you would be, like, superheroes are, like, singularly, like, they're, like, the super cops or whatever the word.
Yeah.
So that if their identity was out there... really powerful and dangerous people could know how to go after
DC is still kind of held strong to the secret identity thing, so... I
mean, it makes sense. They have kind of more Silver Age roots than Marvel.
Exactly. So, I'm kind of on both sides of it. I actually think having Superman not have a secret identity could make for a very interesting story.
Superman has always had... The dichotomy of Superman's secret identity is pretty important. This is kind of like Batman not having a secret identity. It feels... bigger than even Spider-Man's public. I don't like it at all. I especially don't trust Bendis to do it right. But this is interesting. As I read the Screen Rant article that talks about it, they speculate, since Bendis started this whole run about having this thing where people thought that Lois was cheating on Clark Kent with Superman.
Ruck has done a really good job with that in the Lois book.
So
it's put him in an awkward spot.
They suggest that what if the massive twist is not that Superman reveals he's Clark Kent, but they reveal that Superman is secretly married to Lois Lane. That Clark Kent's been covering this whole time or something. And that basically, if they're not revealing Superman's identity, they could be doing a different reveal. Because what they said
is that like a precise wording?
Yeah. I mean, they show Superman taking off the glasses and the coat, and it seems like they're leaving that way. But they say the biggest change in the Man of Steel's life ever... reveal the biggest secret to the world this winter.
I think it's going to be full-on outing, because I think that you have to jump through weird hoops of, like, Clark had, like, a fake marriage to her or whatever.
Yeah, it's a little weird. I think that brings up too many, what if, or what? Why is that? I think you just have to...
Now, of course, it is interesting, because they did do this storyline in a way... As kind of the outro storyline for New 52 before DC Rebirth happened, and they kind of returned it to a more traditional Superman. They had him get outed. I forget exactly how it happened. I remember, like, somehow a story Lois was doing, it was so important that she had to out him for the story or something like that. But
how does
the, I think Greg Pak and maybe one or two other people were writing at the time, and I read much of that tail end run, and I really actually ended up kind of liking it. I thought it was going to be terrible, but I think because I already didn't have a strong connection, and this is weird, in the same way that I now I accepted that the Spider-Man of the movies is not quite in the Marvel Cinematic Universe is not quite my Spider-Man, and I've sort of been enjoying it in this the Marvel movie-verse.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, I'm not big into New 52. I am big into, I guess, the Marvel movieverse, but I did feel like it's like he was kind of absolved of his differences in, you know, this big reveal because it was a world where things were clearly different than what I was used to, and I ended up liking it. They told some interesting stories with it, had some good art from John Romita Jr. and Aaron Kuder, at least it is possible for me to like this kind of story.
Does it fundamentally change who Superman is?
Yes.
Well, I was just thinking about this. Consider this. The Superman as a concept might be a slightly old trope, almost incel-y idea. And I say that because he's always had the idea of, like, this sort of the fantasy that he presented was, oh, I'm meek and mild in my daily life, and women don't like me, and I have to be kind of a loser. But secretly I'm this powerful force. I actually have this, you know, this great agency. And so, like, I wonder if, like, the idea is that the fantasy behind Superman is a little outdated now.
I don't buy that. I think that's a weird interpretation. I mean,
it's the same for Spider-Man 2. Well, anybody who saw Spider-Man Far From Home knows that they were at least setting that up. We'll see what happens.
I'm just wondering,
if Superman doesn't have Clark Kent, Superman has no reason to do anything but be Superman 24 hours a day.
Well, I think he has always kind of...
interacting with his family and doing that.
I think he sort of needs to live as a person, but it does beg the question of, like, it kind of puts more out there, why isn't he, like, if he's that powerful, he should be, like, stopping all the natural disasters. Uh-huh. Like, he should be basically, like, Samaritan.
Exactly.
In Astro City, yeah.
It's a fundamental shift in who he is.
If he could, well, I mean, not. It doesn't have to be.
I think that I don't think it has to be either, because that's also a sort of a meta storytelling thing. All superheroes are potentially should be like working more than they do. They all have personal lives, and we accept that as characters and kind of like as human beings, they deserve to have some normal time.
I feel like while I'm not married to the secret identity idea for everybody, I feel like with Superman in particular, if you get rid of it, either you have to completely change the way you tell stories about him, or what I think Bendis will do, you have to wind up with readers begging the question as to, wait a minute, doesn't this do this and this and this? Like, there's a lot of moving parts if you reveal his secret identity, and I don't think they're going to do it with the care it needs to be taken.
I have this feeling he will have considered those. I don't necessarily think his answers will be ones I like. But here's I guess the reason I most don't like it is because the mythology of Superman is all based in ideas. There's a lot of it that's based around the secret identity stuff.
Yeah.
Like, I like him working for the Daily Planet. I like him, you know, showing up to protect his loved ones as Superman when somebody goes around and messes with them and they wouldn't think that, you know, Lois is that protected or whatever.
I like Clark Kent being a person. And if,
right,
if
Clark Kent is a good character.
And Superman, this is one of the big things that, I don't remember who said it, I don't know.
He can't go and be a reporter now.
Exactly. You can't have Clark Kent be a person anymore. He is a cover
right.
that Superman uses.
Somebody interrupt somebody at, like, a press conference and try and press some politician, and they'd be like, well, I know you're Superman, so you're probably listening to my heartbeat right now. Is that going to make it into your story?
Yeah.
Like, you know, that's, I suppose all of those questions could be, like, They do present new story opportunities.
Yeah.
I don't like the sound of those. You know, last time they revealed Superman, it was because that era was on its way out. New 52 is Rebirth era on its way out. You know,
that'd
maybe
be funny.
That, maybe Rebirth. This is their yeah. This is what their standard will be.
As much as I don't always care for Bendis and his story ticks, he does come up with good ideas, and he does have a nose for creating good things.
I don't know if House of X was like House of Avengers vs. X-Men, House of M, those things. I don't know if those were like actually good ideas.
They were fun ideas.
I actually think, to me, in a weird way, I tend to like moments of his execution better than the big ideas.
I think because Bendis has had some good ideas. Miles Morales, Jessica Jones.
Yeah.
Luke Cage, Daredevil.
Yeah, he did a rethink of Luke Cage that was worthy.
Because he has had some good ideas, and enough of them, we pave over the bad ideas. But he's had plenty of bad ideas.
Yeah,
look at any given issue of The Pulse. That dude had a ton of bad ideas.
No, I think he... I agree with you that he's had bad ideas and bad issues and even bad story arcs. But there are some really good things that he's done. So I think you kind of have to weigh a little bit. And I don't know.
I have a feeling our charts that we made of his pros and cons would all be a little different.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's probably true.
But yes, you, the listening audience, please tell us, what do you think?
Yeah. Curious what you guys think about
Torches
this.
And Pitchforks, or are you like, let's see how it plays out?
I might smell a poll coming on. Should Superman have a secret identity?
Uh-oh.
And if you need Torches and Pitchforks, I will provide them.
You've been collecting them for quite some time.
I have. Waiting for this day. We're going to march on Bendis. All right. That's it for news this week. We'll be back in just a second to talk about comics for the week. We're talking comics for the week of Wednesday, September 18th, and sort of an odd week in that Dave and I are both picking trade paperbacks.
Yes.
And Nick is picking what you would expect Nick to be picking.
That's true.
So Nick, why don't you just kick it off, and you can't spoil anything.
Nope.
Because there's big things in this. This one of the
this
the
is red a red, issue. The red highlighted issue.
Having talked to you about it, I think we can talk around a little bit. I'm going to ask leading questions, and you'll give answers.
Well, why don't you ask me leading questions? Because
right.
I'm not exactly 100% sure how to approach House of X number
all right, let me
five.
Let me see what I can do here. This House of X is not Powers of X or Powers of 10, so this is not the one that's jumping around in time. It's all in the present.
This is in the present day of our of regular timeline.
Tell me who the key characters in this issue are.
Xavier and Magneto.
Anybody else?
And a multitude of X-Men.
Okay.
But it is mainly Xavier and Magneto.
Okay. Everybody knows that those guys, when they show up, there's some fireworks going on. In fact, like the whole X-Men first class movies were kind of predicated on something of the charisma of what Michael Fassbender and who played Xavier.
I always forget his name.
Ewan McGregor. But he's basically James
The other guy.
James McAvoy.
I have been
I'm
watching like the ads for like Dr. Sleep and stuff like that, I'm like, wait, which one is McAvoy and which one is Ewan
exactly.
McGregor?
See, it's the Eisenberg Sarah thing.
Yeah.
No. Not Eisenberg Sena. That'd be different. Jesse Eisenberg looks
nothing
like
John Split.
So they're the leads. Is this one of the big issues?
Yes.
Is it a red flag issue?
It is.
One of those red mark ones? Okay. So What I know from what you told me...
There are many questions answered.
Oh, okay. That's a big thing. And from what you've also said, there's sort of like a sort of new philosophy from Xavier.
Yep.
And I think that you probably... We don't want to say what it is.
Nope.
But it's something that really hasn't ever been applied.
Correct.
Right?
Would you say that Xavier's got a brand new bag?
Xavier does have a brand new bag. Is it a little green bag like the
our dog's holding?
No, but this is a fundamental change in that character,
right?
And sort of how he operates,
right? And of course, since Hickman has as much as said that every new issue will kind of make you recontextualize the previous issues.
This essentially unlocks the very first issue of House of X.
Oh, interesting.
We basically get to see...
You're like, why did some stuff happen and that happened the way it did?
Yeah, we get to see that panel for panel of what actually was happening.
And there's also, as I understand it, some essentially a new initiative, I'm going to call it, dealing with sort of the good and future of the mutant race.
Yep.
That would be kind of a test run for something that would be very huge.
Yes. Whether or not that will continue to hold for two more issues.
Right. But I feel like it could also evolve into something.
It could.
But from what you told us, it is a pretty big thing. And it actually, like, if some of the things the possibilities you suggested for it come to pass, it could not retroactively change past X-Men history, but it could alter how some of that... continues in the present.
Yeah, the cool thing is Hickman has definitely played with timelines, especially in Powers of 10. We're seeing
that's Star Trek territory. He's not allowed to do that.
You can't say that X-Men can't do timelines. They've done so many alternate dark timelines.
Yeah, that's true. I guess that Days of Future Past, I think, happened around 1980 or 81.
Then where's the?
But I just would like to point out that Star Trek did it in the 60s, so they still have a copyright on it and have to be paid every time.
Didn't Rachel Summers come from another alternate dark timeline? And
yes.
Then,
yeah.
Cable's version where Apocalypse took over.
Yeah, you know, the funny thing is, like, that was John Byrne, who was primarily the artist and, like, sometimes co-plotter of X-Men back in those late 70s, early 80s days. He did that storyline, The Days of Future Past, because Chris Claremont didn't want to use the Sentinels, and Byrne argued successfully, very successfully, that he could make them scary again. And so he did that Terminator-like future 2 years before Terminator happened, or two or three years.
How many years after Harlan Ellison wrote the Terminator story?
Yeah, that's true. It's true as well. And it worked. And then Claremont got very on board and started using that Days of Future Past future quite often. You know, it's how he brought in Rachel Summers. He went back to that well fairly often.
It's true. And Hickman has glommed onto maybe not the concept of the concept of dark future, but also the concept of the Sentinels and what that machine hybrid mind. Might be, might mm-hmm. turn out to be, and how you get to that dark future. So,
okay. Yeah. So what you're saying is this art series is already our big hit of the season. People are, you know, they're probably already on board or not by the time of the fourth issue. But you're just saying
fifth issue.
Oh my God, three more issues left.
Yep, is that three right, more total? Issues left.
All right, you're just saying that the shit hits the fan here.
Yes.
In a quiet, contemplative Xavier and Magneto talking sort of way.
Yep, but I mean there are big things. There's big infographics, but
does anybody get punched in it?
Yeah, actually, this one is a more quiet thing.
Does Krakoa at any point make a volcano on himself attack a mutant?
No.
Boo.
There are naked X-Men in this stuff.
Oh, weird.
So there is some
weird. Sounds
nudity.
Like. I'm just going to assume that Krakoa has little, like, cells or whatever where they're born out of, like, little,
I thought you were going to say, does Krakoa have little cameras that he just watches?
No, that's creepy. It's messed up. No, I was thinking of the way orcs were birthed in Lord of the Rings, and I was thinking mutants are just, like, plopping out.
You'd be surprised how right you kind of are.
Oh, yeah, I knew it. Well, you know, the Krakoa is a big kind of scary, organism sort of thing, so it sort of makes sense.
Now, I never knew the giant-sized X-Men would continue to have ramifications on...
Yeah, like 30, 40 years later.
Yep. Silly Krakoa.
That's how I've always thought of him. That silly island Krakoa. Actually, a little bit. It is a little bit silly.
No, he's scary now.
Yeah.
Dave, your pick?
Porn, Randy. I have porn comics.
I know.
Sort of.
Not the first time ever.
This is true, actually. We've had a few picks over the years. So everybody, I think, probably knows about the book Sunstone, or I think most people who might have an interest in it know about it.
Yeah.
But Stepan Sedgwick and his wife have both produced Sunstone and a few other erotic comics, which are also very much concerned about sort of real-world people and, sort of non-vanilla areas of sexuality.
Sunstone is particularly a sort of BDSM and is about relationships and is very beloved as great artwork.
Right. It's one of those that, like... You know how everybody is like when 50 Shades gets brought up among people who are actually into that scene?
Yeah.
They're all like, oh, yeah, it's trash. It treats consent in a terrible way.
Yep.
What's his name is a horrible manipulative abuser. All right. So Sunstone is like the counterpoint to that.
Yep.
It shows real people kind of struggling with some of those ethical questions. But like trying to find, you know, the actual answers you find in those the kinkster communities and stuff like that.
Yep.
So now along comes another one sort of from some of that same group, although the writer is Matt Hawkins.
So
but
it's Top Cow does Sunstone. I think because Sunstone was so popular, writer and editor Matt Hawkins decided to do it with the launch of other books. Because in addition to this one, they have one called Sugar.
Yep.
It's about sugar daddies.
That's right.
And it's also a surprisingly good relationship book. In fact, I like Sugar and this one better than Sunstone because I feel like Sessions is a great artist.
Yeah.
But is like, there's dialogue everywhere and it's too much.
Right, you need somebody to rein it in.
Who's more of a writer.
So let's go ahead and, this is actually the second volume of Swing, his
mm-hmm.
book about swingers.
Yep.
Which I was reminded in the recap of this, because I had read Swing before and I remember liking it quite a bit. It was well done. It is pretty explicit.
Oh, it's very explicit.
This one, but it's also, again, strong character work and some interesting ideas in there. Like, they show people screwing up at things like this at times.
And also people screwing.
But in the first volume, essentially, you've got a guy and his wife. They've got young kids because she got pregnant when she was like 18 or whatever. They were fooling around and they were unsafe, and that's, that happened. But they've made a pretty decent life. Yeah. But I guess the spark has started to fade after, like, what, 8 years together or something like that. And so they're looking for stuff to spice it up. In the first volume, they actually only went as far as, like, hey, let's try and bring in a third person. So they did a threesome thing.
Yep.
And in this one, they're finally kind of ready to try the sort of more serious swinging idea. Now, you might be out there thinking, this is a bunch of pervy, freaky, weirdo stuff. In which case, this book is not for
Probably
you.
Probably not for you.
But if you are at least open to some of the ideas of, like, seeing people apply real, genuine ethical standards to stuff that 1950s white racist people wouldn't have liked, to actually, like, try some, like, a little bit more exploratory stuff, this is actually a really good book on it. It also has naughtiness in it, so you might enjoy that part. It's really nicely drawn by Linda Sedgwick and somebody else, whose name escapes me.
Is it Jenny?
Yishan Lee.
Okay.
I don't know what the division of labor is on that, but it's really good. The characters, maybe as they in Sunstone, they're all a little probably more attractive than real world people would be. But that's not to say there's not some variety within there. Anyway... It was a surprisingly compelling read.
Yeah. Randy, I liked it as well.
What have you?
My book is not pervy and naughty like Dave's book.
Fine.
I have a Fair Lady Volume 1. This is a comic that's coming out from Image. This is issues 1-5 collected in a trade. It's a big giant trade. There's like some extras. These stories, I think one of the stories is double size.
It's Fantasy World Magnum P.I.
Yeah, it is Fantasy World Magnum P.I. is exactly what it is. So Fair Lady is she's a freelance investigator. She is the only woman who does this job. They're called Fair Men, and she is the Fair Lady.
Right. And she had just, like, it literally, I think, was inspired by Magnum P.I. in the sense that he was a Vietnam vet,
yep.
And she is, like, a veteran of, a fantasy war.
There's a big fantasy war that took place. She lives in a wizard's tower. The wizard is away. So she works with the wizard's, like, apprentice who runs the tower and is sort of snooty and is very much just Higgins from Magnum P.I.
Yeah.
She has a Catman partner who shows up occasionally who's very much T.C. Like, the Magnum P.I. influence is very clear. But
like, from all accounts, and I know, like, Anna's been liking this too, it is not something that is just pure homage or ripoff or whatever. No. Like, it's sounds like it's got a strong voice.
It's a series of done in one sort of private investigator stories with a fantasy twist. So, like, there's one of them where she's looking for a barbarian who hired her and then got killed. And there's a lot of people whose deaths are faked or whose it's mistaken.
But when I think about World of Magic and changelings and stuff like that,
yeah.
There's actually, like tons of ideas you could do in a fantasy setting with mysteries.
So I read the first issue of this and was not wildly impressed. And then I came back for the second one and really liked it, and then kind of fell off of it. Anna told me the third issue is the best. The third issue I finally read this week and is really, really good, and has that aforementioned barbarian missing barbarian story. The fourth issue in here, which is the one that really won me over, is The Case of the Missing Page.
Uh-huh.
And it's basically she's hired by this very rich person to find a book. She's to find the last page of a book.
Mm-hmm.
And it is not a spell book. It is not as people suggest, are like, is it, what is it, the book of spells, the book of your enemies? It's like, no, it's a story. It's a story about a prince who goes on the run, there's a magic sword, it's a whodunit, and the last page is torn out of his book. He doesn't know who done it. So she's trying to find the last page of this book, and it turns out it's really hard to find, and there's some great twists and turns.
That's a fun idea.
It is a case about finding a book. There's a lot to this. There's a lot of characters built into it that are like her ex-friends, or her, you know, someone who runs the bar, someone who was, like, the town guard who she's friends with. It's got really nice art. It's got some nice fantasy homages. There's one in here that I feel like is definitely a nod to Ookla the Mock and Ariel and Thundar the Barbarian. Just a little visual nod. I remember
the art being quite good overall.
There's a bit of a Conan and maybe Red Sonja or Valeria riff here. It wears its influences on its sleeve, but it's also just, like, a ton of fun. So I would definitely recommend it if you are a fan of the Private Eye genre, which I am.
Right, or like fantasy stuff that treads in like slightly non-Lord of the Rings circles.
Yeah.
I think that's going to actually end up becoming, I think, maybe a thing with some of our customers. Yeah. That sounds pretty cool.
Now that the trade is out, I would highly recommend giving a look. Also on the docket this week, Blade Runner 2019 number 3, which Dave and I both really enjoyed.
I did too.
Oh, did you like it too?
Yeah.
You don't count with Blade Runner, Nick. You weren't there.
Fine.
This has been really good, and I think we were all a little nervous about it.
Yeah, speaking of mysteries, it's a cool mystery. Yeah. This issue has the big reveals, I feel.
It does.
And I think the third issue is a good place to put that.
The penultimate. It's a 4-issue trade.
Okay, fair enough. I wasn't sure. I assume everything is 6 issues now.
It says to be concluded, so.
All right, nice. It's cool. There's kind of cool twists in each one, but it also has those moral questions that run through Blade Runner. It's really good.
Yeah. Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man number 12 starts a new story arc in which someone tries to assassinate Spider-Man, and there's a story that has a lot to do with him having his ally, the cop, and maybe working with the police for once. There's also some stuff with Aunt May, who's going through chemotherapy. Tom Taylor's Spider-Man is Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man has won me over. It took a while, but it got me. History of the Marvel Universe number 3, as Wade and Javier Rodriguez hit the modern era. This is all the sort of the 60s and all the heroes you know, Hulk, Avengers, Fantastic Four, all those are talked about. Black Hammer Age of Doom number 12, which really kind of brings Black Hammer to a close. They do say they have another miniseries in mind, but this definitely closes out the main story in a pretty satisfying way.
Nice.
Second Coming number 3, which is more of Jesus teaches Superman how to be a superhero. It's a weird book by Mark Russell, who's done, Flintstones and Wonder Twins, and
he's kind of he's the notable satirist of our time. He's the Steve Gerber of the present.
Kieran Gillen and Dan Mora's Once and Future, which is a riff on the Arthurian myths. And then from last week, Black Cat number 4 and Invisible Woman number 3, both of which are just great takes on those characters. Dave, what you got?
Let's see. I didn't necessarily read all of these, so I'm going to mention some, and y'all chime in if you've got something to mention about them.
Yep.
There's the first issue of a new G.I. Joe series. Is it literally just called G.I. Joe?
Yep.
Okay. But it does have, an alternate universe premise, which is that kind of a Cobra One. I didn't get around to reading it, so I don't know if y'all have anything else to inform
us. There's a big death.
Okay. And if I'm not mistaken, the core G.I. Joe guys are in there, but kind of in different ways. They're like insurrectionists.
Well,
in the world.
Basic pitch is that Cobra wins.
Yeah, Cobra wins, and so G.I. Joe is like this underground thing, picking up normal people to be part of their spy and saboteur network and stuff
It's a cool premise.
It's a cool premise. Do we mention this one yet?
Nope.
All right, this is a big thing that I'm sure you're going to be reading a lot about because it kind of also has a notable reveal. But there's a new Spider-Man series? Miniseries?
Miniseries.
Miniseries, yeah. five issues, I think, from J.J. Abrams, famous director of Star Wars and Star Trek movies and creator of Lost and Alias and a bunch of other things. Writing along with his son, Henry Abrams, and artist Sarah Pacelli, who you're going to know from, Ultimate Spider-Man and Miles Morales, and she's super talented. We don't want to say too much because there's a few reveals, I think, we don't want to say, but it's clearly going to be kind of a thing, and I think the fact that Abrams and his son are writing it ends up having some story resonance, don't you think?
I do.
Yeah. There's a Napoleon Dynamite comic. If you were a fan of that cult movie, you might want to check it out. If you hated it, you probably don't want to check it out. But I was one of those people you'd call a fan. I read the first page of it a few minutes ago, and I was like, that's pretty good. The voices sound right, and it has the same weird, dry humor. Star Wars Age of Resistance has 2 issues this week, profiling Rey and Rose from that. I only had time to read the Rose one, but I liked it. It's a story about she and her sister Paige. She was the A-Wing, B-Wing? She was the B-Wing bomber in the movie that got killed in Last Jedi.
Yep.
But this is a story about their past and growing up, and I dug it. Latest issue of Valkyrie by Jason Aaron. Been digging this, and this has an interesting story where Heimdall, spoiler warning, I think kind of happened in the previous issue, but Heimdall is dead, or appears to be dead, and he is asked to go someplace that is not the Asgardian afterlife. He wants to. He's the guy who has seen everything, and he wants to see something he hasn't seen. They describe it as a journey into mystery, and she takes him to see the other afterlives of other mythologies and stuff. And I thought that was a cool idea.
This is a good stinger for the next story arc.
It's an interesting character to bring up.
Yep.
Let's see. There's a miniseries called Flash Forward, which deals with Wally West in the wake of the dire events of... what was that called?
Heroes in Crisis.
Heroes in Crisis, Nick said, yawning.
Heroes in Crisis.
So yeah, that's a follow-up to that. As people know, he was like implicated in some bad things and yet somewhat absolved. And so this is a what is next for him. Nick, I'm going to let you mention that because I think maybe you read it?
Yeah, I read it.
All right, let's just mention it. Inferior 5 from DC. This is a 12-issue miniseries. I don't know really anything about the Inferior 5 other than the notion that I think the comic goes back to, the Silver or Bronze Age for them?
I think so.
This is a new incarnation of it. It's written by Keith Giffen and co-written by Jeff Lemire, who does also a backup story featuring the old Charlton character Peacemaker.
Focusing on...
And it somehow mentions the old early event of theirs, like from the late 80s, I think, Invasion?
Yep.
There seemed to be, as I was flipping through it, a meta element. Like, there, as if they some knowledge of being characters in a story or something?
I think so. It was a little confusing.
Yeah, a little bit. Like, I know this is supposed to have a conspiracy.
I liked the backup a lot.
Was it good?
Yeah, the backup was
cool. Does Lemire draw it, too?
He does.
Oh, I love his art. I need to read that. But yeah, I kind of got the vibe that this might be a little bit of that Grant Morrison meta thing, but like sort of like a group of kids who maybe find out that like that they're fictional characters or aware of like the manipulations of writers in their universe. Yeah. I'm not 100% sure, but I feel like Jeff Lemire fans probably want to check it out. There's a book called Archie 55. It's a miniseries where Archie's around at the dawn of rock and roll. I was checking it out. It's Mark Waid, I think, writes it with Brian Augustine. And I was like, this isn't going to be some story where Archie's like, yes, I, a white kid, invented rock and roll. And I was pleased to see it was a more nuanced than that and that they did not fall into those pitfalls. And it looks like it's going to have an interesting story to tell. Lastly, those facsimile issues that they've been doing where they reprint famous Marvel stories... they do a Frank Miller Daredevil 181. This is the issue where Bullseye killed Elektra back in 1981 or 82 or whatever it was. And I gotta say, just flipping through this, other than laughing at the amazing ads for the Lone Ranger movie toys, Bubble Yum Bubblegum and stuff like that, this is an amazing issue. I was reminded of how intensely great his action art is in this. I mean, how much menace sort of his villains have. So I want to particularly recommend this issue as a great example of how to do a big notable issue from back in the day, whose I think craft I'm going to say holds up against anything today.
I agree.
Nick, what else have you?
I have Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen number 3, which continues to be kind of odd and bizarre and humorous.
You know, it has these things that, like, it actually explains in this issue why Jimmy has gone to Gotham City, why he went there in the first issue.
But it's almost told in, like, a series of vignettes. Told from different characters' perspectives.
They're all a little pop and meta.
Yeah.
And they're pretty fun. Like, there is even, like, a bit of underlying drama to it.
And it's all about sort of a family rivalry between
the Luthers
and the Olsons.
Yeah, like, you have to see, like, his crazy. Tough, like... what's his ancestry? Is it like Swedish or like Scandinavian or something like that? Like his like tough fur trapping ancestor back in the 1800s and stuff like that.
Yep.
So you see, like, what would a tough guy Jimmy Olsen be?
But the cover of this one, I guess this is the variant cover, cracks me up. Is this
great title?
Who shot the decoy corpse of Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen?
Yes, that is an accurate assessment of the interior contents.
That's true.
It's a really funny scene, and it actually involves Metamorpho.
Yes, it does. Then there's Black Panther and the Agents of Wakanda number 1. A kind of offbeat team of agents working for Black Panther, which consists of Kazar, Gorilla Man, Brew, Wasp.
What did you just say?
Brew, the young brood from Jason Aaron's Wolverine and the X-Men.
I only heard... Wait, did you say Brew?
Brew.
Brew.
Is that his name?
B-R-O-O. Brew,
the Brood. Got it.
Yeah. And also... why am I blanking on Jameson? Man-Wolf...
Oh, that's an odd inclusion, but I kind of like it.
Yeah.
They're all odd inclusions.
Yeah, it is kind of an odd, offbeat team, but I kind of like it.
So why did he put them together?
They're kind of just going after random threats, since T'Challa is now, like, the head of the Avengers, which actually I think is a cool idea. He has like separate group, like a strike force that goes after things the Avengers can't get.
Okay, when I was writing up the solicit for it, I kind of got the impression that they might be taking a page from the movie where Wakanda's like, we're going to stop being reclusive and we're going to kind of step out into the wider world, and he was putting together a team to deal with the threats that that would entail. Mm-hmm. But I haven't read it yet, so I don't know.
This also includes the Fat Cobra from Immortal Iron Fist.
It's a fairly deep cut.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a relatively recent character, but that's still a deep cut from what was it? Immortal Iron Fist run?
Yep. So last week also had an issue of Batman number 78. This week has issue 79. Kind of a two-part story of Batman and Catwoman kind of rekindling their romance and getting ready to kick Bane's ass.
Okay.
It's fun.
Sounds good. Bane has apparently been messing with him for about 78, 79 issues now.
Yes, that's true. It's time for some ass whooping.
Yeah.
Absolute
Carnage. I hope that's the cover copy of the next issue.
I really
issue.
Want it to be. Absolute Carnage number 3. Some crazy stuff goes down. Some very Carnage-y type things. Yes, Carnage.
There's going to be Carnage?
There's going to be Carnage. That could also just be the cover copy of the inevitable graphic novel. And then Guardians of the Galaxy number 9. Church of the Universal Truth continues to run rampant. While Rocket and a few of the stragglers who have not been mind-controlled recruit a kind of unlikely alliance.
Is it those characters that are on the cover?
Those are all the mind-controlled ones.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah.
So the Starjammers, Beta Ray Bill...
Most of the Guardians of the Galaxy. In fact, the only ones that are left are Rocket, who is dying,
yep.
Groot... and Moondragon.
I see that Gladiator was among the mind-controlled. Is that correct?
That's unfortunate.
That's a rough one to run up against.
Yep.
So, but I like those kind of stories. I like seriously outclassed hero stories, so I'll have to check this out. I've missed one or two issues in this run, but I've overall been liking what Donny Cates is doing.
Yeah, Donny Cates on anything cosmic, I have to take
He's
a
He's got
look
a good
at.
Feel for it. It feels like a decent continuation of the Abnett Lanning stuff back when.
I agree. And that is it.
All right, that's it for us this week, unless you guys want to talk about it.
Maybe.
Yeah, we could talk about it.
All right, well then we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about evil alien clowns.
Send in the clowns.
Okay, we're back, and we're going to talk about evil clowns.
Yes. Spoilers. Spoiler warning here. This is actually the second adaptation of it. But I think lots of people, so there was the 90s miniseries.
Yep. Similar, which you either loved or hated.
Similar adaptation, by the way, in the sense that I think they broke up both into two parts. I think the 90s one was still just two parts. And I think they both generally split up the kids portion and the adults portion of the storyline.
Oh, dude, I thought the original one interspliced everything.
They may have more. I'm actually going to revisit it soon. I'm going to show it to my sister who went and saw it with me when I actually saw it the second time. Yeah. And I should say, I actually had somewhat mixed feelings just as I did on the first one. But I kind of like seeing this story adapted. For those who haven't read Stephen King's It, the general vibe is almost like Stand By Me. That is to say, so there's the kids portion where you've got this like ragtag bunch of misfits, the Losers Club.
Yep.
Originally set in the 60s in the book, updated to the 80s in the movie. And so there's a Stranger Things vibe, too.
Yep.
And the haunting of their sort of town of Derry by the presence known as Pennywise, a sort of, they will eventually come to know, sort of extra-dimensional being that kind of preys on, like, the casual horror of, like, real small towns and normal people. He amplifies all the abuses and turns everything up. And also... He specifically likes the terror of children.
Yep. Infects the entire town with sort of this malice.
Yep. It Chapter 1, the movie, came out, what, a couple years ago?
Yeah, I actually thought it was really interesting the fact that they didn't know how It Chapter 1 was going to do.
Right.
And they were like, we might
They made it to stand alone if it had to.
Yeah, and they were like, we might do a sequel, we'll have to see how it goes. And the thing just made... like, I don't know, a Scrooge McDuck amount of money.
Right. Well, you know, in the story, the way King did it is he interwove the story of the kids and their adult selves 27 years later.
Because if I'm not mistaken, the book opens with how it chapter two opens.
Correct. With the revival of the murders in the present. And but the kids do defeat Pennywise as kids. Right. They just make a pact that because it's kind of it's one of those things where like defeating sort of a supernatural being, you're like, it'd be like killing a vampire if you were the first person to ever do that and they turn to dust and you're like, well, is it gone? We don't quite know what the rules are. And so they aren't 100% sure, and they decide that if it ever comes back, they make this blood pact. They got to return if he does. Well, he does.
Yep.
But it kind of works neatly in the sense that the first movie, you can sort of give them that victory. And as far as they know, it's a victory at the time. But yeah, movie made buku bucks, like you said. And so...
We get chapter two
with more scenes with the kids, including I think some digital adjustments because a couple of them growth spurted.
But I like that they included the kids because I think some of those kids are great actors. I actually liked, was it Finn Wolfhard from Stranger Things,
who plays the young Richie Tozier, the little you know, all the kids have sort of something to remember them by, and Richie Tozier's the Joker.
Yep,
he's the comedian and literally is a comedian in life. He kind of got one of the stronger roles as an adult with Bill Hader playing his kind of nervous, awkward, but also a successful comedian. Like a guy who's clearly, host shows and stuff like that.
But not without his demons as well.
Not without his demons. And in fact, that's sort of, in some ways...
That's one of the things I like the most about this.
What's that?
The addition to that character. Because that was not in the book.
No, there is a sort of a unique element that's brought up in this one. There's actually, near the end of the movie, without saying anything about exactly what happens, there's like, I would say at least two or three kind of major changes to the book or major additions. One of them is the development of his story.
Yep.
Another one has to do with the sort of, it's kind of the lead character. He's at least the leader of the Losers Club, Bill.
Yep.
And it's sort of a reveal about the death of his younger brother, Georgie, that sort of catapulted everything.
I thought that was interesting.
I thought that was a kind of an interesting thing. And there was one other one. Oh, Stan. The Stan Uris, the hypochondriac? No,
he was not the hypochondriac. He was the one who basically was never really wholly into the idea. He was kind of, he was there, but he was always afraid.
Right. And the original book, like the font for it that says it, is actually the blood that he wipes on the wall after he kills himself when they get the call that they need to come back to Derry.
And that was a major downer in the book.
And it is in the movie, but there's just something more, and I don't really want to say anything more than that, but it was an interesting notion.
It was a good thing.
And so actually, even though I had somewhat mixed feelings about this movie throughout, I thought it ended really strong with like several choices I thought were good ones. The last 5 or 10 minutes are great.
There are some excellent sequences. I don't think it's like the best movie ever made, but I think it is a very good movie. Where I thought the first one was definitely a bunch of jump scares and a lot of Pennywise running at your face.
Right. Pennywise does have a thing where he like does something scary and then he suddenly comes after you like he's some kind of super fast Silent Hill creature.
And this one, they do that a couple of times because it has to feel sort of in line with that first one. But they kind of expand it a little bit. Mm. There's a scene with a little girl under the bleachers at a football game.
One of the stronger scenes.
And I was like, this is the Pennywise that I would imagine as being like the creepy, but also kind of like that opening scene with Georgie in the boat.
Right. He has to have a certain allure to really make him seem terrible.
And Bill Skarsgård, I'm sure he had a ton of fun playing this character.
With his drifting apart eyes.
Yeah.
That apparently Bill Skarsgård can actually do, and it's not CG.
I've seen that meme.
Yeah. Actually, I've seen only that meme, and I don't even know whether to trust the meme. It's probably true, but it's, in any case, it's a funny meme. There's these emotional ups and downs as the characters return. There's a lot more humor in this, don't you think, Nick, than maybe even in the first one?
Yeah.
And that's kind of odd. Usually you amp up the stakes in the sequel, and I think in a way they might have decided that since the first one had so many kind of big scares in it, that they were like, let's try out something that's a little bit tonally different.
Yeah.
So there's the threat is still overall amped up, but there's... almost more of this Stranger Things humor vibe run into.
Yeah, and there's the rekindling of relationships, because once they leave Derry, they forget.
Right.
Which,
I always liked it. Straight out of the book.
I always liked it. It was a cool concept. But you kind of forget that they forget about their relationships with each other.
Right. And so they lose both the traumatic memories of what Pennywise did to them when they were kids, but also the friendship bonds that they forged.
Yeah.
And there's also, by the way, there's another change from the book. There's another choice made near the end that has to do with that, and I liked that too.
Yeah. And then you get the adult cast. You not only get Bill Hader, which we've already mentioned, but also James McAvoy, who does a good job as Bill.
Yep.
Jessica Chastain, who
she's great as Bev.
And then there's a couple of, I didn't recognize them, even though I know they have done a bunch of stuff. Who the kind of chunky kid becomes sort of like the rich
Ben's
character, architect.
Yep.
He's from something, and I actually really liked him in this quite a bit.
Yeah, he did a great job. I think all the casting was pretty spot on.
And I love the other guy, which I can never remember his character's name, the germaphobe.
Oh,
yeah.
God
again,
damn it.
Yeah, his name I love the character.
It is the one that I always lose to.
I love the character, and I thought the adult playing him, which I did not recognize, was great.
Yeah. I'm going to say something kind of harsh here. It'll come off slightly harsher than I mean to direct it at the movie. But I think that there's a certain lack of subtlety to the way this guy directs movies. And it reminds me a little bit of Zack Snyder. I think he's a little heavy-handed, that scenes feel a little telegraphed to me. I think he's better than Zack Snyder. But there's some of the same things that I don't like about, say, how Zack Snyder sort of directed Watchmen, and how that was an adaptation, and it kind of became a little... He kind of hammered home some points and lost some of the nuance that's really at the core of it. I felt like this lost a few things that I really liked about the book, and even in the previous adaptation, one of which, just as an example, that they kind of leaned into in the 90s adaptation, was this notion that really, like, the kind of at the heart of what's terrible about this is that the people of Derry turn away from what seeing kids abused and bullied and bad things happening, and that's a big part of Pennywise's strength. Here, he's like clearly a recurring curse every 27 years, and they get a little bit more into the mythology of like where
they
he came from.
They sort of showed that in the first one.
Right, it was glimpsed, but they didn't lean into like, why exactly is he so kind of horrible? Like, you know, what makes him worse than any sort of recurring magical threat? I did sort of lament that wasn't there. There's a weird homage to another horror movie, you know what I'm talking about, that like straight up quotes the other horror movie, and I was like, that's an odd choice.
It was. We also know that there is a 4-hour cut of this movie.
Yeah, and in spite of the fact that I said I brought up Zack Snyder, and that's a very mean thing to ever do about anybody.
Well, I had to remind myself Andy Muschietti was the guy who did Mama. Am I misremembering that?
Is that the director?
I think this is the same director.
That sort of makes sense. I liked Mama, but also found it heavy-handed.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of what he does. I don't think it's a bad thing.
It's a semi-bad thing.
Well,
It's a choice.
Sometimes horror, it's okay to be heavy-handed. I don't think it's necessary, but
it's not what I love.
Right.
But clearly it is what audiences are digging, because I believe this second one is doing very well too.
Yeah.
I will watch a potential 4-hour cut, or what I've heard the director mentioned, like, of splicing the two movies, filming some new scenes to fill them in.
I would watch a 6.5-hour cut of this movie.
Yeah. I do think it's a story that benefits from sort of an epic tone. It has to feel epic.
I listened to an interview with him, and he said what he had to cut was a lot of the interpersonal stuff of, like, between the characters and things like that. I think we have to talk about Stephen King's appearance.
Okay.
Because
he has a Stanley appearance.
He does have a Stanley. It's actually even more so, because he does get more than a few lines.
He gets like a minute or two of screen time, which if you've seen some of his previous appearances movies, you might be like, uh-oh.
Yeah.
But this is a better done scene,
He plays
think.
A purveyor of kind of a junk
shop. Like a
shop.
Junk shop, yep. And there's a little bit of a meta joking about his own writing, in a way.
Oh, very much. Which I actually appreciated. But
Stephen King, because he is now a gaunt old man, is not bad at playing a kind of slightly snarky, gaunt old man purveyor of junk.
Turning on his main accent to, like, 11.
Yeah, it's a it was a fun scene. I liked it. Yeah. In fact, the my only regret is that the reason that Bill is in that junk shop, and I'm not even going to quite say why, is something that's a bigger thing in book and previous adaptation, and I hope that it makes it into the longer cut.
Yeah.
Anything else to say about it?
No.
I'm going to say, like, I overall have, like, a solidly positive view of it, but there's enough drawbacks that I don't know if I'd buy it. I'm going to, like, but I do expect to, like, watch it again. My dumb brother will probably buy it.
But, Dave, you don't buy stuff like me and Nick do.
I do sometimes with movies that stand out.
I bought the first one, so I will have a compulsion to buy the second one.
Yeah. Is that how you got Matrix 3?
I don't own Matrix 2 or 3. I only own Matrix 1.
Sometimes they come in a set.
That's true.
How I own the Sum of All Fears.
That's yeah. how I own, what is it, Live Free, Die Hard? No, Ooh. No. What's the last one?
I don't know, Die Hard in Russia.
Yeah, it was Die Hard in Russia, which I've never watched. I saw it in theaters once, and I was like, oh.
Ow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I at this point, I don't buy box sets anymore, but I remember getting the Jack Ryan collection for Christmas at one point, and it came with Sum of All Fears, which I'd never seen. I'd heard it was terrible. Ben Affleck was in it. Morgan Freeman. I'm like, I'll watch this.
How
bad can it be? The answer is really bad. Terrible. I want my 2 hours back. I
read an article recently that, was it, who did those movies? Was it Paramount or somebody? Yeah, they were offering, I guess, Alec Baldwin all this money to continue to be that character, and he didn't want it.
Alec Baldwin, Harrison Ford, right?
Alec Baldwin did Hunt for Red October. They wanted him in Patriot Games, and he turned it down. That's and then crazy. I think they were just keeping offering him money. I guess, I don't know if they didn't like Harrison Ford.
That's funny.
Yeah.
I'm just like, dude.
Yeah, anyway, Sum of All Fears is terrible. It's
awful.
And if there's one thing to take away from It Chapter 2, don't see the Sum of All Fears.
Don't see Sum of All Fears. To sum up, don't see Sum of All Fears.
That's right.
I watched a Netflix show called Spy, which is a it's based on a novel that I think is a nonfiction novel, or at least a fictionalized version of nonfiction, about an Israeli spy inside Syria, inside the Syrian government in the 1960s. It is the star of this is Sacha Baron Cohen, who you might know as Ali G or Borat.
Yeah. Borat, yeah.
He is playing it 100% straight. It is a drama.
I've always gotten a vibe that he could probably pull off drama.
He's great in it. Yeah. The lead character is he's an Israeli man. He's married to a woman, and he basically gets recruited to Mossad. And his handler, played by Noah Emmerich from The Americans, is sort of, he's not sure about him. He's like, he's too eager. He's got something to prove. He shows a quick natural talent for sort of picking up all the skills of basically being able to spot a tail, being able to sort of disappear into roles, all this kind of stuff. And so they send him into Syria as this businessman who moves increasingly up the chain of the Syrian government and is also trying to sort of work with people trying to destabilize the government and change it. And it's really fascinating. It's got some real historical stuff. Bin Laden's father is in this as a character.
How do you set up somebody as a businessman? Do they actually have to like invent a business or?
They have. It looks like basically what they did is that a man and his wife who had died, they had a big textile company. They introduced him as the previously unknown son of these people.
Okay.
And they basically built the story around that.
That's interesting.
And so he basically is being funded by the Israeli government, but it looks like he's just this rich guy.
Now, you talked about historical figures. I actually somehow lost in the basic breakdown. Is this based on a real story,
yes,
or is this
it
fictional?
Is. It's based on a real story.
Got it.
And he basically goes in and befriends all these people, whether it's the nephew of a big military guy or a general to get a recommendation letter to move to Syria. He presents as a guy who always lived in, I forget where it was. He lived somewhere in Europe, but he presents as a guy who, his father was from Syria. He never got to go there, but he's a true patriot and he wants to go back. And so he basically infiltrates this whole thing. It's got a lot of that sort of scary stuff where he's like, he's in a room taking pictures, you know, while security is coming around. It's all like old spy craft. Like the way he gets his information out is he has a furniture factory. And they wrap up the furniture in newspapers from Syria, and all these newspapers make their way to his Mossad handlers, and they basically have newspapers from Syria that they can use to gather intel from.
Interesting.
And he uses Morse code. He has a Morse code handler, so he like.
What is this running on?
It's on Netflix.
I'm going to check this out. This sounds up my alley. Actual spycraft sounds like, in addition to being just fascinating for its own merits, it sounds like a terrifying way to live.
It is. It will definitely give you anxiety at some points.
I also think, like, because you would be, like, called on to, like, befriend people that, you know, you are, in many, like, completely betraying.
Yeah, yeah.
The notion of, like, whatever your moral compass is, like, you have to be dedicated to an ideal in a way that few people are, I think. Yep. Because you will be making personal betrayals in order to, engage in some higher ideal. And I don't know if many people live up to that.
He leaves his wife and his children behind for years.
Yeah.
To go live as this other person. It's fascinating. Sacha Baron Cohen is fantastic. Noah Emmerich, as always, is fantastic. It's a really, really good show. And it reminds me of what I liked about The Americans and what I liked about The Night Manager.
Yeah.
It's in that vein.
And it's just literally called Spy?
It's called Spy. It'll probably be on your featured Netflix. It's one of their originals. So
Cool.
Yeah, it's only 6 parts. It's like 6 hours. So
I like it.
I binged through it and definitely recommend it. Nick, you also binged a Netflix show, staying up far too late to watch it.
I did. I think I stayed up till 4:30, almost finishing it all in one chunk, because it is a compelling show. It is called Unbelievable, and this is also a true story. It's about a young woman who was raped in kind of like a halfway house where she was living. And the police did not believe her and basically convinced her to recant her story while the serial rapist went on to do it to multiple other people. So it's a little bit about the...
This sounds utterly horrific.
I do not recommend this if...
Traumatic. All the trigger warnings.
Yeah, all trigger warnings.
But it's also
a very traumatic story.
This is reality, though. This is something that, like... So many women and men, but primarily women have had to deal with these, like, the utter horror and also the fallout of it.
Is the story also about two female detectives take on the case?
So it basically starts out in 2008 and will time jump to 2011, where 2011 is sort of present day, where two detectives sort of have their own cases going, and by happenstance, because one of the detective's husband is working in the same precinct as the other one, connect the two cases.
Okay.
And sort of they join forces and sort of continue on. Those two detectives are played by Toni Collette, who is amazing.
Toni Collette's been rocking it. Yep.
And the other one is Catherine Dever, which I did not recognize her until... Merritt Weaver. I'm sorry.
Merritt Weaver from AER, from ER?
I don't know if she was... Was she in
she
ER?
She was in ER.
She was played, in Studio 60.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That was where I recognized her from. But she plays the other detective, and she's great in this.
Yeah, she is great.
The main character, who plays sort of the young woman who is Caitlin Devers, who I was thinking of, who you will probably recognize her if you saw Booksmart. She was one of the leads in that.
Yep.
And then there's, like, a whole cast of characters that you're, like... I know that from that show or that
movie. A lot of good
movie.
Character actors.
Yeah, and it's an amazing... It's a compelling story. It's hard to watch, but you get to see the ineptitude of police, but you also get to see some of the flip side of that where you get cops that actually give a shit.
Right, a dedicated person who can maybe make a real difference.
Yeah, who actually are good
at
their core, which is a little bit nice to see.
How long is this? How many
parts? It's eight episodes. Okay. So it doesn't linger too long. It is very compelling. It's a show run by Michael Chabon.
Okay.
Pulitzer
Prize winning.
And also, I forget her name, but the writer of Aaron Brockovich.
Oh, okay.
She wrote the... there was another HBO
That's a pretty impressive
movie.
Team.
Yeah, it's...
Now, I have a question about this. Is that I don't know, like, the exact nature of, like, the kind of story they're telling, but I do know that... Whenever I see, like, news articles on this, like, really nasty topic, there's always, or, like, and I'm looking at message board threads, there's a lot of stories and, like, a lot of talk about, like, oh, well, you know, she just made that up, or these are just women who have regrets or whatever, and even though that's, like studies have, shown that this is, like, a very small percentage overall of the cases of accusations, but does this follow showing why somebody would... maybe recant their story and might appear to be a dodgy witness when, in fact, everything is, like, true?
Correct. Yeah.
Like, do you get some insight into that, do you think?
Yes. The main character, her life up to that point was horrific. Mm-hmm. She'd been out through multiple homes of foster parents, some good, a lot bad.
Yep.
And basically she...
She's sort of like flailing, like just like looking for like something to cling on to and like, okay, if this is what I need to do to get it. Or...
A little bit. Okay. It was basically like her core belief in what, like adults, like was shattered. Like,
interesting.
She should trust them and do this. And of course, that is not always the case.
Right. Well, this sounds harrowing, but I think this is also one that I would like to check out.
It is harrowing, and there are scenes where I was like, that's maybe a bit much.
Oh.
But ultimately, the story is very compelling. I hate to say watchable, but the character interaction and sort of the way the story is told is really, really well done.
The best filmmakers I find when they handle serious topics, sometimes topics that would make you say, why would I ever want to watch a movie like that? They will find there is a human connective tissue to be told in these stories when you tell a story and it's not like a message story. And it sounds to me like this isn't just this is going to be a message or something like that. This is a story about real people and people, if you portray them well and you write truthful scripts and stuff like that, you're going to be drawn into their stories.
Yeah.
And it sounds like they did a good job on
that.
They
did.
All right. That'll wrap it up for us this week. We'll be back next week with more. Until that time,
yo, Joe.
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating and review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.